This is tape one, side two of The Impersonal Actor. Let's do an exercise now which will further illustrate about feelings. We'll start, just as an example, with anger. I want you to direct anger at an imaginary person in an empty chair across the room from you. But don't make this anyone you really know. This isn't therapy, just a brief exercise. Now, we're going to pick something to project to that unidentified person in that chair. Your communication is as follows. Don't do it yet. Just listen.
Would you please shut up?
Now, while you are still seated, I want you to deliver this charged, personal communication to the unidentified person in the chair. Do this now. Do it again. Make it as angry as you can. If you really did this exercise and did it fully, you are at this moment surrounded by a negative, angry, hostile, highly personal aura. You feel it, don't you? It has an actual vibration to it. And in the case of punishing or chiding, this is a specific vibration. So you see now that you did not have to feel your communication before you did it. Your feelings were an inseparable part of your communication. You can no more truly communicate without feeling than you can give without receiving. So you see, you don't have to be in the least concerned about feeling anything as an actor, because first of all, you do feel deeply. And secondly, you don't have to be concerned, because if what you are communicating is clear and accurate and truthful, the correct feelings are a foregone conclusion to what you successfully accomplish in communication. To then need to feel is to embrace redundance, and therefore to cloud what, if left alone, is perfectly clear. Know that this is true. Let's look at another example. Now, I want you to, remaining seated, pretend the roof is off your room and look into the sky of one fantastically beautiful day. The unidentified person in the other chair is there to receive your next communication, even though it is to be delivered while looking upward into the sky. Now effortlessly say the line, "God, what a beautiful day." Do it now. Notice that the moment you initiated this communication, you feel yourself surrounded with an aura of delight, a resonance of positivity, even if it is subtle at first. This positivity is the exact simultaneous flow of a communicated witnessing to beauty. And if your communication was true, the attendant feeling is perfect, instantaneous, and completely apropos. We humans are as fast as the speed of light. We are light. To think in terms of our feelings being the sole primary active force of our nature is to slow us down to a crawl, an integral part of our nature, yes, but you know that we are often the pure response of common knowledge, separate from our individual opinion. In other words, we often as not respond, relate, and communicate, whether we realize it or not, out of our common humanity as much as out of our personal identity, sometimes even more. This doesn't make us lemmings, only part of a greater whole. And in that event, we are as much communicating out of the force of a common mind as out of our single opinion. In fact, upon further observation, you can see that most negative communications are personal in nature, and most positive communications are universal in nature. So that in positive communications, the feelings are universal, and in negative communications, the feelings are highly personal, though not unique. Feelings are not always communicated, but when they are, well, my teacher put it this way, that with communication comes a free flow of feeling. That's a different philosophy entirely than thinking that feeling is stored up and then released into communication. What we are addressing here is the perceived need to really feel something before one can communicate something, when for the purposes of our craft, what we as actors must do is be able to truthfully communicate, and simultaneously we do deeply feel. Removing problematics and negativity from the work. Remember how Clark Gable said, "Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn," to Vivian Leigh in Gone with the Wind? The very best in our industry know certain things so well, they all know how to keep intelligence, objectivity, and humor in the work, and how to keep negativity and problematics out. Some of the greats started their careers as highly personal actors, but few have remained that way. They have learned to remove from their work, from the portrayal of their characters, arbitrary pettiness, punishing, complaining, superiority, visible hurt, and self-pity, and are actors who instead look for, assume, and portray openness, wit, irony, humor, objectivity, constructivity, coping, caring, and giving, unless the writing has defined it otherwise, and this is true for heroes and villains alike. They know that what is dramatic is that characters we care for do often run out of these traits, but so much want to embody them, and that there is no poignancy to limitation without there first being great potential. Let me repeat that. There is no poignancy to limitation without there first being great potential. Even John Cleese's Basil Fawlty is usually trying to be charming up until he's just fresh out of politeness and patience, the point being that Basil's crudeness is meaningless without his primary desire to be winning. They all know how to play characters who deal with issues and not personalities. Then they can really be passionate, because when our work is issue-oriented, it cannot be petty. That's why when we're playing petty people, the thing you play is not how personal they are, but how they harp on small issues. You're probably asking, why remove negativity from the work when we see it so often in life? Understood that from time to time you will be playing characters whose effect on themselves and their world is indeed negative, but your acting will not be negative. In life, we are, most of the time, almost all of us, coping rather than not coping. If this weren't true, nothing would ever get done, ever. We spend most of the time seeking harmony. Even quote-unquote bad guys are seeking the harmony of their preferred lifestyles. That doesn't mean that we're all happy, but most of us are rather dealing with the world a more or less successful degree in the hope of finding a harmony which has the name happiness. It can even be rightfully argued that sometimes that desire to cope well even interferes with the recognition of something wrong in our lives, something which we should in fact fix. But that's therapy, not acting. Drama may be good therapy, but therapy, for the most part, is not good drama. Dramatically speaking, a disagreement is different from a fight. While things are in a state of disagreement, they are still in the constructive process. Often in acting, we mistake disagreements for a destructive process. When this happens, it steals the thunder from the true moments of conflict, which are built into the writing. In good acting, most disagreements are to be played as positive exchanges. We'll discuss this in detail later in Love Scenes. For the moment, know that disagreement and conflict are not the same thing. In general, avoid playing petty in the work. Even if the writer has written someone who is petty, do not act it that way. Play someone who's trying to be gracious, but the words are all wrong, and they will be perceived as even more petty. Avoid being nasty. The minute you think that your character is being nasty, you will more than likely be correct in playing him being nice, but saying terrible things. This is not to suggest an arbitrary choice of playing the opposite of what is written. Assume that in intelligent writing, that the writer's intention, or the way he or she heard it when it was written, does not necessarily follow the apparent intent of the words. Here's what I mean. A wife might have the line, "Why the hell did I marry you?" Let's say that it comes in the midst of a passionate exchange. The chances are the power of the writing is captured in the reading, which includes all that has gone down between them, not just that which is going on right now at that moment. So that the writing is fulfilled, not in the obvious angry reading, "Why the hell did I marry you?" but in the almost smilingly humorful, ironic, "Why the hell did I marry you?" Avoid chiding, which is punishing another person. Be logical. We will not watch a story about someone who's always negative, even if there are some people like that in the world. It's universal law that negativity cannot rise above circumstance. Therefore, most writing is about people who cope and get better as people, or at least who try and sometimes perhaps tragically fail. Most good writing is about redemption or the quest for redemption. There's a somewhat well-known book on auditioning, which promotes the most remarkable arbitrary technique at gaining the attention of casting directors. It says that if your partner in a reading isn't giving you anything, how's that for taking responsibility for your own work, and the reading is going nowhere, then punish the other reader with your dialogue. Now, is it our intent as artists to practice our craft with love or with loathing? That doesn't mean that we won't portray hateful people. We will. And we'll love doing it. It's great fun. But the hate must not be in ourselves or in our craft. The hatefulness is in the things our characters do, which we all know is often served up with great intelligence and delight on the part of our villains. Good villains do their jobs well. They believe in the ultimate righteousness of their actions. Good actors know this. The truly dangerous man can kill you while feeling completely justified in doing so, and sometimes with a smile on his face. Walt Whitman said, "Oh, what is it in me that makes me tremble so at voices? Surely whoever speaks to me in the right voice, him or her, I shall follow as water follows the moon, silently, with fluid steps, anywhere around the globe." Now, persons familiar with one another, as in families, do chide one another from time to time. But again, it has no meaning if done continually, and cannot justify characters hanging around to listen to it. It isn't long after the first, "What are you doing?" that we've had quite enough, and we must give our characters the same distaste for a put-down as we ourselves possess. If we do not, then our characters look captive or frightened or both. Now, if they're supposed to look that way, that's something else. Just remember that in scripts, with the exception of being testy for the fun of it, most punishing takes place when the target is not present. How do you handle it if your character is written to remain in the room, but you're working opposite an actor who is incorrectly playing his character as abusive? One effective way to deal with this professional transgression is to have your character choose to remain in the room in order to see more of this behavior. Playing the victim is another problematic so often seen in the work. If a character's feelings have been hurt, we already know it. We've been watching the story. We were there. Don't we know what he's feeling already? Isn't what is really interesting is what he does or says in spite of his hurt? And if the writing doesn't prescribe a loss of coping, isn't it logical to assume that he is indeed coping, or at least putting on his very best face? What's actable is how he deals with the situation, which, often as not, will be with humor. These are the things which are likely to be in writing when our character is quote-unquote hurt, as opposed to showing hurt in order to project how deeply we feel. In review, what arbitrary negativity and problematics in the work do is make your character petty and small. And the odds of your character having been designed that way are very low, also true for villains. If your character is not the lead and is supposedly a petty person, what are the odds that he or she wants to appear that way? Have faith in the writing that less than attractive characters will be perceived that way because of the words they use and by their actions. Let the proof of their unsavoriness be in the pudding, not in the photograph on the recipe. Technique. 1. Play a character who copes well until he can no longer as prescribed in the writing. 2. Assume a disagreement between characters is part of a constructive process, not part of a destructive process. 3. Avoid playing petty, nasty, punishing, and complaining unless and until prescribed in the writing. 4. Avoid playing the victim. We know when your character is hurting. What's interesting is what he does with it. In this way, you will begin to overcome the one-dimensional, stereotypical portrayal so often offered up to producers and directors. If we as actors begin to serve up truly living three-dimensional roles, two-dimensional writing will cease to be rewarded. Conflict. Remember the exchange between Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman in Casablanca when Rick meets with Elsa again at the café? Or in The Lion in Winter, when Queen Eleanor and King Henry meet again at the boat landing? Or when Martin Sheen finally meets with Marlon Brando in The Village in Apocalypse Now? Or in Tootsie, in the bar, when Charles Durning says to Dustin Hoffman, "The only reason you're still alive is that I never kissed you"? Once, after working through the opening scene in John Patrick Shanley's play Women of Manhattan, the actresses approached me a bit troubled and disturbed. They were feeling unfulfilled in what we were doing because they were not, as they put it, playing the conflict. They were convinced that this opening scene between friends who are a bit drunk and feeling good but a little sorry for themselves, as Shanley puts it, was really an argument of some kind. After all, as one of the actresses put it, "I've always been taught that the basis of all drama is conflict." They both felt that what I had them doing was a bit undramatic. It did little good to bring up the subject of Shanley's opening notes, which specifically instruct, among other things, This is a play about friendship and problem solving. He goes on to add, please don't be mean, arch, or slick. Please do be loving, natural, and vulnerable, and a little rough around the edges. But the actors were fearful that this wasn't dramatic enough. Remember what one of them said, I've always been taught that the basis of all drama is conflict. Indeed it is. The basis of all drama. But not the basis of all acting. The basis of all acting is the avoidance of conflict. Ask yourself the question, do I, for the greatest part, try to engage in conflict in life, or do I endeavor to avoid conflict in life? The answer is true and the same for the vast majority of all people in the world. Thank God it's so. There would be no time for advancement if we spent all our time working out our deep-seated aggressions and inadequacies, engaging in all potential conflict that happens to come our way. While it might be an incredibly effective way of dealing with stress, it would be the behavior of a complete dysfunctional. Ideal psychological behavior is as much a total of all behavior as it is the sum of one healthy moment. Because everyone has to get through the gate, and on Earth it seems that everyone cannot go through it at once. So we wait, we step aside, we slow down, and we hurry up. We avoid conflict because most of the time, and up to a point, it's better that way. When it's not better that way, we have conflict. That's what writers write about. The things that reach a point to where they're not better that way. It's not that humans want to fight, it's that they don't want to, but do anyway. And more importantly still, the things they fight about is often much more important than themselves. We call those things which are more important than our egos, the things which go on whether we live or die, issues. We'll discuss them in detail later, but for now, let's look for a moment at George and Nick in Edward Albee's great play, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Act 2, George and Nick are having drinks alone while Martha is with Honey, who's being sick. The big trap here is to be concerned with the conflict between the two men. Concerned that what is most important is the visible, if mercifully witty, antagonism. To be sure that the audience sees the conflict between older and younger, sees the tension between an earlier world and a later one. But once again, these things we know. This is what we already perceive. We understand instinctively that there is a competition going on between young man and middle-aged man, between two professors at the same university, between the up-and-coming and the entrenched, between age and beauty and all the other things we know about, understand, and get as part of the experience. So this is where we actors start. Not from that place at the beginning, trying to somehow play these tensions and relationships between them. The tensions and relationships already exist in the audience's minds. That's already accomplished. To try to establish that is to waste valuable time. Richard III is not about a bitter and resentful man. It's about how bitter and resentful a man can be, but not as expressed through his bitterness and resentment, but through the horrible deeds he commits and the pleasure and delight he takes in committing them. So now back to George and Nick. Obvious is the conflictual stuff we at once perceive exists between them. What's news, that is to say what is to be acted, is that they like each other and respect each other, see themselves in one another, and see right through each other. And thus, we know that they know the threat, real or imagined, which they are to each other. And this all with great humor. This is what intrigues us. Not that they can be nasty to each other. Just as in the same way what intrigues us is not that George and Martha can be mean to each other, but that they can offer their cruelty in such loving ways. And what fascinates us is not that they are at odds, but that they are in conflict and yet communicate clearly, wittily, and intelligently. We like them all, and they like each other, and that's why we care about the conflict between them. We will not care about the conflict between them if dislike is what is acted. We will perceive them as clumsy, short-sighted complainers who have no human gift of adaptability, the thing we humans are known for. What almost all drama is about is not the expressions of conflict, but about the handling of that inevitability, for the conflict is what we expect. What's news is what comes before and what comes after it, and that's what the story is about. We could go on and on about why conflict is not the heart and soul of acting. But you know, it all comes back to this thing of artistic control. For so often it is the personal actor who wants to have the right to decide when and where in material his character runs out of coping, which ironically is often when the actor has, and there introduce conflict into the material whether it is written to occur there or not. By avoiding conflict, the audience will be riveted to their seats by the experience of watching something that they feel sooner or later has got to give. It stands to reason that if what sooner or later has got to give is always giving, there will be no drama at all. That's why we do not play out so-called builds, which actually occur in an audience's mind because they are watching people avoiding things which sooner or later have to be dealt with. Conflict comes when coping has failed. Disagreement is the time before conflict in which fixes are offered but not agreed upon. We often prematurely introduce conflict with characters between whom conflict will later erupt. Conflict is meaningless if it has existed in the acting all along. This is a common error in soap operas where only conflict is thought to be dramatic. It would be well to remember that an audience's attention is more kept by the natural variance of the unpredictable human condition than by the steady flow of aggression to which even the most adamant fan becomes numbed. Actually, an unsuccessful attempt to resolve pending conflict is far more dramatic, as we will later see. Looming conflict, or a build, is perceived by an audience not because of measured out or repressed hostility in the acting, but because two characters who are compelled to remain in one another's space, physically or psychologically, consistently disagree, not fight, disagree. In life, one never knows when a fight will break out, between friends, enemies, business partners, husband and wife, but we perceive that something's coming because of a non-stop exchange of unacceptable solutions. Remember high school. It wasn't out of shouting matches that fistfights erupted. It was out of one or two words. Conflict erupts out of failed communication. To quote Anton Chekhov, "Let the things that happen on stage be just as complex and yet just as simple as they are in life. For instance, people are having a meal at table, just having a meal, but at the same time their happiness is being created or their lives are being smashed up." Or as Sakata Tojiro said, "When one sees present-day actors playing a serious part, they're always slapping their scabbards at faces, confronting each other with sword-drawing postures. Can one call this sort of thing serious acting?" In review, in drama, moments of conflict, which come often as not unexpectedly, are rare and are really only one part of what is dramatic. The foundation of acting is the avoidance of conflict. And it is by this that moments of true conflict are defined. Let's do an exercise with the line, "You don't know what you're talking about." Do it now, engaging in conflict. Now do it again, avoiding the conflict. Your last rendition has created a build in the audience's mind. Technique. As you look at the lines you're given, look for how your character is making apparently contentious moments into apparently cooperative ones, or at least trying to. This is the end of Tape 1 of The Impersonal Actor. We'll continue our discussions on Tape 2.